It is 8:30. We have with us live in the studios once again, Jeff Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy spring.
Oh, yeah. Weather's finally warming up.
Kind of.
But enough. Good enough for me. All right, lots to cover. Starting out with, it is no longer in the PI. The PI
No, that's not true. The unexpurgated views of Official Seattle are in the PI. It's their big selling point now that you can hear directly what the people who make decisions that control our lives have to say. It's sort of like, you know, well, like Pravda. That's some similar model. No, the PI died on Tuesday, which was a sad day. Not so much for the loss of newsprint as opposed to pixels, because that's just the delivery system, but the fact that PI laid off 85% of its employees, and the resulting online PI is, how do we say this politely? It's a disappointment.
It's not even a shadow of itself. It is absolutely dreadful. I mean, I went online Wednesday thinking, okay, this is the rollout issue of their online edition, right? And the three featured writers were Jim McDermott, Dorothy Bullitt, and the head of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. And I just thought, you know, if this is a sign of things to come, this is just... You know,
yeah, the whole idea of journalism as the fourth estate, as a medium that we protect with an amendment in the Constitution dealing with free speech, is that it will hold decision makers' feet to the fire, not that it will print their words. And in order to do that, you actually need live bodies that will investigate stories and do primary source reporting and then bring that information to the public. I mean, there are local blogs in Seattle that have more information and more original reporting than the new PI does. It's really pretty discouraging.
Right, and if you're looking for real news, you can scan down below the opinion pieces, which are featured prominently. I think that's a new move in terms of news content site in the first place. Generally, the opinion people, unless it's strictly an opinion rag, usually the opinion people are off to one side, and then you have the real news making the headlines up front, not with this new online PI edition. But if you scan down below the opinion pieces and the photos of Seattle's richest and finest, you get to supposedly the newswire feeds, and what you're getting is I don't know who is selecting what goes up on the PI site, but what you're getting is the "my dog got run over by a car" and "another kitty rescued from a tree" kind of stories. You're not getting anything that's real news.
Yeah, the thing about even the opinion pieces, because the web does opinion very well, and probably some you know, brain trust high up in Hearst figured, well, we need to have more opinion because that's where the readers are going. Well, yes, the readers are going there, but they're going to people who, number one, can write opinion well, and there are a lot of people out there who can, and, you know, Jim McDermott and the head of the Chamber of Commerce are not among them.
Right.
I mean, they're not picking people who are particularly good writers in the first place.
Wealthy,
so it's not
wealthy philanthropists.
Yeah.
It's
not particularly interesting to read in the first place. And then these are folks who have their opinions represented in mainstream media all the time, and in local media. You're not getting any of the opinions of folks who are, you know, have more of a distance from the decisions that are being made and can give you any kind of perspective on them. You're just getting a regurgitated official spin, and it's very, very it's not particularly useful. So Hearst was making a lot of noises about, we want to experiment with the online model, we want to try and find a business model that works, yada yada, and there's no question that that's a necessary thing to do, that we need to figure out a way, we being, you know, citizens in a democracy, need to figure out a way to have either a business model or a nonprofit model that can make it financially sustainable for an institution to do primary source reporting, because without that we can't figure out what the decision makers are doing and what decisions are being made that affect our lives.
And it's not a bad thing to do it without print, because as we know, print wastes a lot of resources.
Yeah, and it also costs a lot of money for the distribution system, and that's not where the eyeballs are anymore. But you know, the advertising model simply doesn't work for online because it's so undervalued on the one hand. And, you know, because of that, Hearst doesn't want to carry the amount of staff that it does. But the staff that it is carrying and the features that it are running simply aren't the answer. And for a deep-pocketed institution with you know, a lot of fairly media-savvy people like Hearst to think that this is the way to go is really pretty discouraging.
All right. Moving on, the single surviving daily in Seattle this week had an investigative follow-up to the city's snow response.
Hey, an investigative follow-up. What a concept.
Yeah. You know, the city and the city council couldn't undertake their own review of the documents that were generated around the city's snow response in late December. And so the Seattle Times did an FOIA, and they undertook their own investigation. What they found is that the manager who was in control of the city's snow plows had absolutely no experience in managing a storm-related emergency. He'd been a former manager of street surface repairs. And his assistant really had no experience at all with transportation issues. He'd come out of a different utility department. And that during the snow response, these guys managed to divert plows from a list of roads, major arterials that should have been cleared. They sent a lot of those work crews over to West Seattle to clean up the streets and sidewalks around the part of the city where the mayor lives and the deputy mayor lives and the head of the Department of Transportation lives. And that they also found that the city rarely had all of their snow plows in use at once, and that even though the head of the city's Department of Transportation said that the fault lay with snow plow drivers who didn't radio in and didn't write in their reports that street conditions were so bad, so managers didn't know where to send them. In fact, the opposite was true. The Seattle Times found that snow plow drivers regularly radioed in and wrote in their reports that city streets were in terrible shape and that many arterials were not being plowed or cleaned properly, and that city managers did nothing to help that. And so what is the response? Well, the mayor wants the Ethics and Elections Commission I don't understand his reasoning here. The Ethics and Election Commission.
He has elections on the mind right now.
I think that's got to be it. Yeah, I think that's got to be it. And in fact, at least one city council member, Tom Rasmussen, has been asking that an independent auditor be brought in and look at this situation and review what the city needs to really do in order to get prepared for the next big snowstorm.
Yeah, I really don't think that the Nichols administration can be trusted to independently and objectively audit itself. It's just not the kind of administration I think that engages in a lot of self-reflection of the dispassionate what's best for the city kind.
Yeah,
but it does explain when Greg Nichols went before the cameras and said he thought they did a great job if all the streets around where he lived had been plowed.
That's true.
Yeah, that's true.
Important got done.
All right. Moving on to Olympia and things that did or didn't happen.
I know. In the last couple of weeks, we've mentioned some major issues that climate scientists have brought up about global warming. Some new data that's come in that says right now we're on the cusp of we're in a critical period. We've got only a couple of years to make the decision to cut back on greenhouse gas emissions before we tip the balance into catastrophic climate change. And so how do people respond in the states that are looking at passing, say, cap and trade bills? Here in the state of Washington, Governor Greg Warr had proposed a cap and trade bill for capping greenhouse gas emissions by business. And then, of course, businesses would have to, you know, pay to emit more greenhouse gases, or they would trade credits, et cetera, et cetera. And people probably know how the cap and trade system works. Well, that bill didn't even get out of committee in Olympia. It died a sudden death. And it was mostly because business leaders went and said, you can't do this during a recession, threw a little weight around and probably some money around in Olympia, doing largely what I think the Labor Council, the Washington State Labor Council, tried to do last week and got their wrists slapped for that.
Police investigation for that. An investigation, by the way, which the state police laughed out of their bailiwick this week.
Basically said the Washington State Labor Council didn't do anything illegal. You know, this is essentially saying what we said. This is the way the system works. What are you guys doing calling us for this kind of garbage? So, you know, it's interesting to note that the cap and trade bill, something that is absolutely necessary, it doesn't matter that we're in a recession right now.
I think nature will wait until we're in a good economic period before it decides to, yeah.
Yeah, that's the business philosophy anyway. So it seems like Seattle business and Washington State business leaders are perfectly okay with eventually having most of downtown underwater.
Yeah, well, the discouraging part of this is one of the more progressive states in the country when it comes to climate change initiatives. So if that's the climate for actually getting anything done at a scale where it'll make an impact here, think of what it's like in some place like, you know, Tennessee or Arkansas.
Or
Washington, D.C.
All right. Well, speaking of Washington, D.C. and going on to national, how about the events economic news this week?
Oh, yeah. No, we heard a lot about the AIG bonuses. That's
way too much about the AIG bonuses.
I know. Right? It really knocked any other kind of economic news off the front page when it hit on Sunday and Monday. And right after people heard about it, the vilification and the lynch mob mentality came to the fore. And that's all we've heard about all week, really, is the AIG bonuses here and how can we get the money back, et cetera, et cetera. And I just want to put the reins on that a little bit and say, hey, wait a minute. If the federal government had stepped in when they gave AIG the first bunch of money and said, we're taking you over, we're going to nationalize this company, this never would have been a problem. They would have gone in and replaced the entire executive crew, and they would have said, okay, an AIG right now would not exist as a company. They would have broken it up and sold off the pieces and made it into several smaller companies. And this would never have been an issue.
And the scandal right now isn't the few hundred million dollars in executive bonuses. It's the, you know, exponentially larger pool of toxic assets that the U.S. taxpayers are on the hook for without actually having any influence over how the company is run because we didn't nationalize it in the first place.
We didn't take control. Yeah. So when the federal government doesn't step in and say, okay, we control this, we're calling the management shots right now, we make the decisions on compensation for people who are in this company. We decide whether this company is going to survive or not. And you can do that either by nationalizing the company or by stepping back and saying, okay, we're not going to rescue you. You have to go through the bankruptcy courts and the judge, and whatever judge you get assigned is going to do that. However that's done, that takes care of this kind of a problem, and this issue doesn't come up. But, of course, there's a complete fear of the N-word in Washington, D.C. You can't use it right now. And it really points to the issue of how much more responsive Congress and the Obama administration is to the banking industry lobby than they are to the American taxpayer. Right now, what people should be focusing on is instead of, you know, demonstrating outside AIG corporate headquarters or trying to find out the names of these executives, we should be calling up our own senators, even our state senators here in the state of Washington, and saying, what are you doing to get the bankruptcy legislation passed through Congress?
It also underscores why other countries have been so incredulous at the U.S. response and how that response has been very, very different from what other governments around the world faced with similar situations have done. We have not intervened in the very markets whose lack of regulation and a lack of oversight created this problem in the first place.
Yeah.
Instead, we've just thrown money at them, which they don't seem to mind.
Yeah, until you stabilize the housing market, you can put as much money as you want into these banks. You can do you can pour as much money down that black hole as you like, and it's not going to help.
Well, you mentioned bankruptcy legislation. So is there something meaningful currently being proposed?
Oh, yeah. It's been trying to make its way through the Senate. It got passed in the House, and the banking industry lobby has been trying to water it down as much as they can. It's basically the proposal that housing advocates have been pushing for a long time, and that the but that the president now says that he supports, although I don't see him cracking the whip with the Democrats in Congress who are not supporting this bill. But it would give bankruptcy judges in bankruptcy court the ability to take the mortgage debt that that a person going through bankruptcy has on the books and renegotiate the terms of their loan. Currently, bankruptcy court judges can't touch the mortgage. They have to let that, they have to let the bank just do whatever, you know. They have to try to help the person find some way to deal with their mortgage debt, or they let the bank take over the house. But if you give bankruptcy court judges the power to renegotiate the terms of the loan, they can step in and say, okay, look, this adjustable rate loan, I'm throwing this out, man. You figure out the value of this home. The bank has to write off the rest of the principal that's owed on that loan. We're going to write down the balance of the loan to the value of the house, and then we're going to set the rate at a reasonable 3% or 4% or something like that. That could give us real stability in the housing market. That could put a real halt to the drop in housing prices all over the country if the federal government would do that. Of course, the banking industry says, oh, my God, no, we are so wedded to eventually getting our money out of these people who we wrote these terrible loans to that we are not going to let this bankruptcy bill pass. And I have to just say, people ought to be calling up their legislators, their representatives, their senators, and saying, how dare you let these banking industry lobbyists in the door? How dare you listen to them? How dare you let them say a single word to you? Because you don't represent them, you represent us.
Well, and the sad part about this is that the banking industry lobbyists in this case are you know, cutting off their nose to spite their face, because, you know, if the economy continues to tank, they're going to lose far more money from those conditions that they would lose from renegotiating these loans. But, you know, these are the same decision makers that got us into this trouble in the first place.
Exactly.
So it's not surprising that they don't understand the nature of the problem, let alone the solution.
Yeah. And, you know, if you gave judges the ability to, these are called mortgage cram downs, by the way, if you gave judges the ability to do a mortgage cram down, the housing prices and the housing market would stabilize very quickly, because then it would become very obvious what the value of all of these adjustable rate mortgages are. They would be changed from something you can't value into something that you suddenly know what the value is, and it would take a lot of the uncertainty out of the market.
Yeah,
and that would be to the benefit of shareholders and to the benefit of these banks.
Yeah, because the problem right now is that people don't know what these assets are worth, and you know it's a crisis of uncertainty, and that would fix the problem.
It would. It would mean banks would have to own up, take the losses right up front, and then they would stabilize.
All right. Well, did the Fed come up with a solution this week to help us instead?
Sorry, we shouldn't be laughing. We really shouldn't.
No, the Fed had a surprise announcement this week, one that just completely shocked economists when they said that, when Bernanke came out and said, well, we've got this new idea, we're going to print $1.2 trillion and we're going to pour that money into the economy and try to prop up the system. We're going to use that money to buy up long-term treasury bonds.
That really worked for Mugabe and Zimbabwe, didn't it?
Yeah, and I'll just explain very briefly what that's going to do. Right now, the Obama administration is taking on a ton of government debt by all of these bailouts and their economic stimulus bills, et cetera. Well, treasury bonds have been falling in price because there's too many bonds out there and not enough people to buy them, even though China's doing their best to try to buy up as much as they can. Well, that makes interest rates rise, and that's a problem for the economy. So the Fed figured they had to jump in. They had their meeting and they said, well, we can't lower interest rates anymore because we've lowered them to zero and it's not helping. What we can do, though, is we can buy up treasury bonds, which is essentially what they're doing then, is they're printing money. And what that does is that drives down interest rates and it makes it cheaper to borrow if you can borrow. The problem is not that it's too expensive to borrow. The problem is that nobody has the good credit anymore to be able to qualify for loans. But hey, you know, who's listening to me? But the problem with printing money really is that it sparks inflation. and it drives down the value of the dollar. When you drive down the value of the dollar, it makes imports more expensive. And as you know, just about everything we consume here in America these days is an import. And we're, of course, already seeing signs of inflation with the price of oil and other commodities spiking almost immediately after the Fed made its announcement.
Yeah, and it's particularly dangerous given that the U.S. already has a huge foreign trade imbalance.
Yeah, and so it's brought on deficit worries, you know, and people are saying, look, you know, if now you've got the Fed printing money in order to buy up U.S. government bonds, this is an act of desperation, and we're going to be driving the deficit up above sustainable levels, and everybody's arguing about what those sustainable levels are. The truth of it is, when you have a huge deficit, when the government is printing money in order to try to keep the economy afloat, it's a sign that things are bad. It's not that the Obama administration is treading water or just flailing. It's that they're not responding to the problem. They're not taking the steps that have to be taken in order to really stabilize the system. It's a sign that they're doing these things that are acts of desperation instead of the hard and necessary choices they need to make. And I just want to remind people, look, when Obama was elected, he said, I'm going to expect people to call me up and tell me what they want me to do. I'm going to expect you guys to keep me honest. And that's what people need to do.
Time to do it.
Now is when people need to do it.
The problem right now with the management of this economic downturn is that the things that need to be done are not being done, and the reasons are political and ideological. They're not failures of imagination. The solutions are all out there. The problems at this point are political, and they're the will to do things that have words associated with them like nationalization that give people the heebie-jeebies.
Regulation,
which we still haven't seen any of. You know, we talked about this a couple weeks ago where, you know, there's going to be a very vague plan that comes out sometime next month. But every week that this goes by, that there's no new regulation and re-regulation, all of those toxic practices that got us into trouble in the first place are still happening.
And the
reason they're still happening, again, is because of the power of the banking industry and the other lobbyists, and because there isn't the political will to do the things that are necessary.
All right. That moves us on to international, starting with Pakistan.
Yeah, it was a messy, messy week in Pakistan this week. The government and Nawaz Sharif, who is the former prime minister who was part of the power-sharing agreement, had a nasty split. Sharif was actually put under house arrest, then bolted from house arrest, and then was leading a march to the capital city with a threatened mass sit-in to try and reinstate the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who was kicked out by Musharraf a couple of years ago. Well, that Chief Justice was actually reinstated yesterday, so that crisis has been somewhat diffused now. But you've got the government of Pakistan, a nuclear power, having a badly split coalition government at this point, at the same time that it also has the war and instability going on. It's a very, very dicey situation for Pakistan and for the Obama administration.
Well, in addition, one of the interesting things about the reinstatement of the chief of the Supreme Court justice was that it didn't come primarily because of the demonstrations. It came largely because the military stepped in. The head of the military there in Pakistan stepped in and leaned on the government and said, you got to do this.
Yeah.
Which brings up the issue of, okay, is Pakistan heading back into a military dictatorship or what?
Yeah, which is a very, very real possibility. Anytime you have this kind of instability in Pakistan, the one stable institution there that continues to maintain a lot of power and an independent base is the military.
All right, moving on to Iran.
Yeah, interesting this week for Iran. Obama sending out a Persian New Year greeting to Iran and an overture that was rejected by Ayatollah Khomeini and by the Iranian government as saying quite correctly that it was all style and no substance. Funny how they can see through these things and we can't. That there's been no substantive change in U.S. policy. And as if to underscore that, Ellen Tauscher, a former former representative was named Hillary Clinton's Undersecretary for Arms Control and Proliferation this week. She is one of the most conservative Democrats in the House, or was in the House. She also shares that role, which is key to Iranian relations, with Dennis Ross, who has been named the Middle East envoy in charge of basically Iranian affairs. And he's also known as a notorious Israeli hawk. And then you had, the same time Obama was making his overture, Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres undermining that with a much more hawkish message directed toward the Iranian leadership. So there's all these forces that are still gunning for a military strike and war with Iran, and doing so in advance of Iranian elections coming up in June. And we had this week also probably the best known of the various challengers to the hardline Iranian leadership withdrawing from the race this week, that being Mohammad
Khatami.
There are still a couple of challengers in the race, but all of these times that you have these threats to Iran going on, it helps buttress the hardliners' position within domestic politics in Iran.
All right. Israel?
Yeah, we mentioned the foreign minister for Israel, the new foreign minister for Israel under the coalition government that Netanyahu, the Likud leader, is trying to form right now, is going to be Avigdor Lieberman. And we've mentioned him in past programs as the leader of the previously minor party, which finished third in the elections. It is basically a fascist party. Lieberman is called, among other things, for the forcible removal of all Palestinians from Greater Israel, force of loyalty for all Israeli citizens of Palestinian descent, and various other things that can basically be called fascist. He has been named as the new potential foreign minister for Iraq, for Israel. And this really is basically Israel telling the rest of the world to go fishing. It really does underscore how much of a turn to the hard right the Israeli government and the Israeli electorate has taken, and how little it cares, because naming Lieberman to a foreign minister post is going to engender the overt hostility of most of the rest of the world, and real isolation on behalf of Israel. And you know, whether it will matter in Washington, D.C., where our leadership seems to back Israel no matter what it does, is another question. But certainly for the rest of the world, it's a bad, bad sign for where Israel has headed and where the rest of the world can respond.
And finally, El Salvador.
Yeah, good news in El Salvador this week. The election of its first leftist government after the 20 years since the civil war of the late 80s and early 90s, Mauricio Funes of the FMLN was elected. There was interference, as I mentioned last week, from the U.S. trying to swing the election to ARENA, the hard right party, but they didn't, and so now El Salvador joins much of the rest of Latin America in going to leftist democracy.
All right. And events for this week?
Several of them. This week, as we mentioned, is the 6th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. The state of the anti-war movement is such that there are 3 different anti-war protests going on this weekend. Today in Tacoma, there will be a major one, starting at Jefferson Park at 9th and Monroe at noon, and then going on to Wright Park. Here in Seattle, the world can't wait, drive out the Bush regime, which the world obviously did right, and the Bush regime is now in comfortable retirement. But anyway, they are having an anti-war march at noon at Westlake Park, and then tomorrow, I think there'll be one that's been a little bit better publicized, that'll be at noon at Cal Anderson Park on Capitol Hill, that one being sponsored by Answer. Also going on this week, on Friday the 27th, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility is sponsoring a forum called the Nuclear Comeback, talking about nuclear energy making a comeback in the United States. That'll be at Keystone Church at 5019 Keystone Place North. And then on Thursday, the city council is having a hearing.
Yeah,
a
budget hearing. It turns out the city council is looking at trimming the budget yet again, and if people want to show up and tell the council members what you think ought to be priorities in the city budget, you'll show up at 5:30 this coming Thursday in city council chambers to let them know.
All right. And that's it on events.
That's it.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and the King County Public Library, other places where you find free periodicals around town. And you can find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org.
And we have kicked off our 2009 fundraising drive. So if you can do anything to help out, it's an all-volunteer publication. You can go online at eatthestate.org and contribute or send contributions to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And if you have any comments or questions or didn't get any of that information, you can give us a call at area code 206-719-6947 for our voicemail.